Kathleen?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. I didn't mean to jump out on front on you there. Well, we're going to start day two of the Oregon Employment Department overview, and welcome to our members. Welcome to all those out in the audience today. Mrs. Lincoln, you want to come on up? All right. And then you were sharing with me how you think we should proceed. Why don't you take a moment and share with us?
Mr. Chair and members, first thing I would point out to you, before you at your place, there's a packet of information from the Employment Department. It's responses to, I think, some, if not all, of the questions from yesterday. I'll just leave that there for your reading pleasure. I think the process that we'd like the agency to use today is, now that they've done their overview yesterday, if we could have them go back through their binder behind each of their program areas, starting with unemployment insurance, be turned to the last page in there. You have their detailed priority lists for that division or program area. We could just have the agency and the administrators of each section come up and describe each of those functions to give you a little bit more background on what each of those tasks are, and then talk about kind of how they prioritize within that division. And after they've completed that through all of their divisions, if they could then go through more detail of their 10% reduction list. I guess with that in mind, moving into phase two, phase one, you're not asked to do or affirm anything at this point, but you need to have enough information to help you do the work in phase two. So reserving enough portion of time to ask questions if you have questions on performance measures or any of their priorities. We could do that at the end if that works.
Perfect. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Debbie Lincoln. I'm the director of the Oregon Employment Department. Glad to be here for the second day. And following Monica's description, I'll ask Tom Byerly, the assistant director for unemployment insurance, to work on his program priorities. And we're starting following B12.
Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Byerly. I'm the Assistant Director for Unemployment Insurance for the Employment Department. And as Debbie instructed you, we have a fold-out page there right after B12 that lists the four priorities for the unemployment insurance program. The number one priority for us would be to pay unemployment insurance benefits. And what's included in that is processing the initial application for the claim, as well as the continued weekly claims for benefits. This also would include the adjudications of any eligibility issues that arose from the claim. We talked about the performance measures for those areas yesterday. Included in that would be basically the staff that are in our three UI centers, because they're processing the initial applications and the continued claims. It would also include the staff that are on site to do the training of those employees, as well as some central office staff that process Social Security number changes, name changes, modify some of the wage records to make sure that the claim is at the proper monetary value. So that's all the staff and infrastructure that would go into getting those unemployment insurance checks and benefit payments out to our customers. Second on the list would be, of course, collecting the UI taxes and the quarterly reports from employers. It's those taxes, those contributions, if you will, that go into the unemployment insurance trust fund that we use to pay the benefits. That'd be our second priority, would be to keep the trust fund going so we can continue to pay benefits. Third priority for us would be the unemployment insurance benefit payment control area. This is a group of staff. It's approximately 35 employees that detect and process unemployment benefit overpayments and do the collections of those monies. And the question yesterday was, had to do with the efficacy of those programs, and I think it's number 14 in the handout, if you have a chance to read it later, that we provided. Talks about some of the highlights we were doing in that area that we're continually looking at. Fourth on our list of priorities would be the unemployment insurance tax audit and collections function. This would be the staff that go out and audit employer accounts, make sure that employees are properly classified, ensure that the right amount of payroll is being reported and that their taxes are indeed accurate. Those are the four priorities for unemployment insurance. I'd be happy to entertain any questions if you had some.
Any questions? I actually have one or two questions.
Great.
If I may. On priority number two, the collection of unemployment, tax wage reports, and quarterly payments from employers, is there a funding formula that determines the correct level of collections we need to be at? How do we know when that trust account is adequately funded?
Do you want me to do them?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have a benchmark that's written into statute, and I've got a whole presentation on how those revenues are collected if you want to go over that at some time. It'd take about 10 minutes. But the statute benchmarks the amount of money in the state unemployment trust account, and it's at this point it's set at a certain amount of benefits at a certain rate of insured unemployment. That benchmark is, if we were at 7% insured unemployment, and that's not the unemployment rate you see in the paper, that's only those people who are actually in the unemployment system for 18 months. We do have our proposal, House Bill 2127, which proposes to lower that benchmark because over the last two recessions, that trust fund has been very healthy. And we can lower that trust fund, which will be a savings of about $200 million over the next 4 years to employers. What we're proposing is to lower that benchmark to 5.6% insured unemployment rate for an 18-month recession. So we take a look every August at how much money is in the unemployment trust fund, the state unemployment trust account, and figure out which tax schedule we need to be in order to meet the statutorily required benchmark, and then that's what tax schedule drives the collections for the coming calendar year.
So statutorily, then, that over a period of time, that rate will go up or it may go down. You folks are continually adjusting it based upon the need of the trust account.
That's right, Mr. Chairman.
That's correct. It's forward funded, so we fill up the fund when times are good, so the money is there to pay out when times are bad. And my hesitancy to answer the questions that Debbie's been pitching her tax package around the state, and it's a pretty good one.
Another question I have, going back to priority number one, when you did the consolidation, can you share with me what happened to the employees? Were they laid off? Was there an opportunity for them to relocate?
That's a great question, Mr. Chair. Thank you. We did reduce overall the number of positions that we need to deliver unemployment insurance benefits by nearly 90 positions. What happened with those staff is many of them we had. There was a point when we began looking at our strategic plan in 2002 that 25% of our staff were eligible for retirement. Some of those positions became vacant due to retirement. We reallocated many positions to the BNES, Business and Employment Services side of the house to focus on business and job placement. And those positions, staff were given the opportunity to move, relocate to the Business and Employment Service office that they wanted to work at. Others were able to obtain jobs in other agencies. When we announced these reductions, staff had nearly 2 years to determine where they wanted to go before we made those moves.
The last question I have on that is, were there vacancies in buildings? And if there were, how are we handling the new space, the old space, I guess?
Mr. Chair, we committed to having a zero increase in square footage by doing this. We picked up two new buildings for the Eugene and Metro Area call centers. So our plans for the Business and Employment Services offices, where space was vacated when UI moved out, was to either locate with our partners or Workforce Investment Act partners or other kinds of partners, or bring those partners in to locate with us and essentially rent out the space to them. The Department of Labor and the Workforce Investment Act sees all those workforce partners being co-located physically so that the services are available in a one-stop manner. So our goal is to be co-located with partners, and by moving UI out, we've made room for people like Vocational Rehab and Workforce Investment Act and even Goodwill and some of our other partners to move in. So that's our goal, is to ensure that we have that space all taken up and we have no net increase. The other thing that we've been able to do is give up some of the space that our outstation child care and hearings officers and tax staff have, and pull them into either field offices or the UI centers. So we've been able to get rid of a few leases that way and collapse staff into buildings we're already in.
Thank you. For those... Oh, Senator Berger.
Director Lincoln, let me be sure I understand when you're talking about the reduction, when you're talking about the benchmark reduction.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a reduction that I'm going to see in the 10% reductions, or is that not a reduction I'm going to see?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, it's not a reduction, the 10% reductions, because that's a reduction to employers and the taxes that we assess to them.
Okay.
So it simply is taxes that we will not be assessing, which we would have assessed had the formula not changed. So it's not an expenditure on our part. It's a reduction to employers' taxes.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
For those members who came in a little bit late, we're going back through each of the sections and going through the priorities that they have provided to us. And then also we're going to take a look at the 10% reduction and have the folks from the unemployment department share with us their thoughts on that. As you're going through your priorities, can you also share with us what funds the priorities? So that way, I don't want to get into real in-depth discussion on it, but just at maybe a 30,000-foot level, you could share with us how those priorities are funded.
Mr. Chair, let me just real quickly be sure everybody's on the same knows what it is we're looking at here. On these sheets, on the far left column, the priorities, we have both the priority within the individual division as well as the department's priorities. So Tom has in UI 1, 2, 3, and 4, and in terms of the department's overall priorities, those are 2, 3, 13, and 18. So that's how you read that. Then as we go across... the fund sources, we don't have any lottery funds, so that will be empty. We do have general fund in child care, $3 million, so you'll see that there. Other funds are often federal funds expended as other funds. The non-limited other funds are our state unemployment trust account. Those are the benefits. Federal funds are what we get from the feds to provide administration. Other funds also include our Supplemental Employment Department Administrative Fund, and we can talk more about that later. To the right, we do show what kind of reductions we anticipate in our 10% reductions, but if it's all right with you, I think it would work better if we went through the priorities and then did the reductions as a whole department-wide rather than doing it division by division. And then the citations and so forth that support what it is we do. So just to give you an idea of how we look at this. I also want to point out as we go through this where these fit in the governor's priorities. For the unemployment insurance piece, these fit with the governor's priority for providing Oregonians with basic daily needs as well as for his economic development priority.
Thank you. We're going to move to the business employment.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Well, just real quickly, Tom will tell you what...
funding source for employment.
The funding source, yeah.
Thank you.
For payment of unemployment insurance benefits, the other funds would be our one-time READ Act funds that we receive and our READ Act distribution from the federal government. The non-limited other funds is the unemployment insurance trust fund that Debbie just spoke of. And then the federal funds of $76 million is our unemployment insurance grant from the U.S. Department of Labor. For collecting UI tax and wage reports, again, there's a small amount of READ Act and other funds. And then there's $14.7 million under the federal funds. That's, again, our unemployment insurance grant. For benefit payment control, priority number three, $3.1 million of that is from our state fraud collection fund. That's interest that we collect on benefit overpayments that the legislature allows us to use to fund these activities. And then in federal funds, again, as part of the unemployment insurance grant, $4.5 million to cover those expenses. Under the UI tax, unemployment insurance tax audit and collections of delinquent employer accounts, priority number four, we have nearly $2.5 million, which would be the one-time READ Act money, and then the $4.1 million of federal funds from our unemployment insurance grant.
Question, Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, also, as you talk about the collections for delinquent employer accounts, you're going over the income that's received from them. What is the balance of the delinquent accounts?
You should have that here handy somewhere. Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, right now it's at $18.7
million. Okay, thanks.
You're welcome.
Oh, one follow-up, please. Do you have any outside collection agencies involved in the collections?
We do turn over some of our accounts that are hard to collect to the private collection agencies.
Okay. That's been a discussion, I think, every session. I know at least for the last 4 years that's been a discussion. Any other questions? All righty. Thank you.
We'll move to Business Employment Services. Tracy, welcome.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Tracy Loudon. I'm the budget manager for the Employment Department. I'm speaking on behalf of Business and Employment Services as we recruit for an administrator of that division. If you'll turn to the tab that's called Business and Employment Services, and the very back following page C12 is the holdout for Business and Employment Services and the ranking that we have for this program area. The first item for the department is priority six. It is the largest piece of this division. It's, if you look over at the total funds area, it's $77 million, and it primarily funds our field offices that we had talked about in our presentation yesterday. We have 48 locations around the state that deliver these services. The services are provided to upwards of 500,000 available applicants that are composed of job seekers and people who are unemployed or on unemployment insurance that we call claimants. The services that we provide them include vocational guidance, job search assistance, and identification of training programs that they may be eligible for. The funding for this includes $60.2 million of state other funds that Director Lincoln spoke about. One of the major sources is our Supplemental Employment Department Administrative Fund. You'll hear us refer to that as CDAF, and we have a presentation on that later on. The federal funds come from the Wagner-Peiser Act. One of the questions that was asked yesterday, and there's a handout that we gave in our responses that describes the Wagner-Peiser Act and how the federal government, Department of Labor, asked us to use those funds. The second item on this list is ranks number 10 for the department. It's veteran services. We receive grant funds from the Department of Labor specifically to serve veterans. They get similar services that we provide our other job seekers, but it's a little bit more focused, more enhanced. We provide services to disabled veterans, and we provide services to veterans with special needs. These funds represent about $4.8 million. The number of veterans that we have potentially to serve within Oregon is around 44,000 per year. Item three on this list is the
really
TRADE
quick,
Act program.
Really quick. Yes. With so many of our men and women serving overseas and soon returning home, do you see the need for additional service to the to these returning home men and women?
Thank you for the question, Chairman Smith. The services that we provide the veterans are both supported by those core services I talked about earlier, as well as these additional $4.4 million that come from the federal government. We are required through U.S. Code 38 to provide preferred treatment to the veterans. And so we know that as they're coming back, that there's a potential for more veterans to be available for services in this. It comes at a difficult time for the department in our funding strategy because the Department of Labor has been actually reducing the amount of funding for the department for these specialized services. We do our best efforts to take care of those veterans with the first item on the list, which is our core services, to make sure that veterans are all served and taken care of even when there's a larger influx of them coming in.
Let me ask one more question on that. How are you going to reach out to these returning home veterans to let them know that this service is available to them?
The Employment Department, in providing services to veterans, does a number of things. There are veterans organizations, domiciliaries that are available, and our veterans reps that are placed locally in the field offices will go to those organizations that have contacts with veterans, and we do a lot of publication of information that is available to them. In a general nature, as well as going specifically to locations where they are. At different times in the past, the Employment Department has been responsible for grants from the veterans that include grants for homeless veterans or incarcerated veterans, veterans with some really special needs. Mm-hmm. And then we go even further out trying to locate those veterans that we can provide services to.
And, Mr. Chairman, we work very, very closely with the Oregon Military Department and with the Department of Veterans Affairs, as well as with the – we got housed across the a corridor from my office, the DOL, Department of Labor, Veterans Education people, who have all sorts of connections with a variety of veterans. We are looking right now at doing some marketing along with the Department of Veterans Affairs and the Military Department of all the services. Our folks work together with them. They go have made trips to up to Fort Lewis, for example, to meet with veterans who are coming back, groups of veterans coming back, to tell them what kind of services we have and so forth. So we are doing everything we can to get the word out that those services are available.
It might be very helpful if you laminated a card for each of the 90 members, so that way as we come in contact with these folks, we could forward them on. Senator Johnson.
Thank you. Something then isn't working, and I think this is less a question to you than it is a statement to my colleagues. I keep hearing from veterans that there is a reduction of services. We share in Columbia County a veterans officer with Washington County, and that person's time has just been cut in half. And so I share the chair's concern that at a time when we're creating more veterans, many in need of a greater level of service, given the fact that they've survived wounds that may not have been survivable some time ago, they're coming back, and it seems to me that there's a diminution of services. At least that's what I'm hearing from constituents. And if we have little pieces of veteran services scattered throughout a number of agencies, is there a way that we can fix it so that veterans are not running from one service delivery spot to another service delivery spot? And I don't hold you guys, I mean, this is not, should not be implied as a criticism of what you're doing, but more a call to action of this body to see if there's something that we can do to coordinate and simplify the whole array of services that are available to veterans, particularly at this time and place in our history.
Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, I absolutely agree. A few years ago, we had close to 50 veterans reps. Right? Now we have 44. But the money for the employment veterans reps has dropped from the federal government over the last few years, and we continue to stretch thinner and thinner to serve them. So I absolutely agree that certainly the federal government has some responsibility to deal with that. I also would mention that our vets reps have already testified to the House Committee on Veterans Affairs, and along with military and DVA, and so I know there's quite a bit of interest in this body around services to veterans, and we will be most happy to bring whatever information and do whatever we can to help those folks get services.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. I think Ms. Lincoln's just made my point. If I heard you correctly, you said you offer services to 44,000 people. You've got 1,000. I mean, you've got 44 representatives to do veterans work. That means each one of those people potentially carries a caseload of 1,000 people. Mm-hmm. And given the magnitude of the needs of our veteran population, I don't know how one caseworker can manage a 1,000-person caseload. So I think you've helped make my point.
Yep. just like to make a comment.
Representative Richardson.
I'm a vet, and I'm not a case. Mm-hmm. So the fact that they may have 44,000 divided by 44 doesn't mean that there's 44,000 vets that have any need for services at all.
And respectfully, Representative Richardson, while you have no need at all, there may be other veterans that have such complicated needs they'd count six times for your lack of need.
Certainly we could look at what the actual caseload is and get a feel for how it's divided up. But I just think that throwing the statistics around doesn't really get to the heart of the matter.
Well, thank you. But we're going to continue to move forward. This is an issue that I think deserves further consideration. And between now and round two, I would strongly encourage both of you to join me in working with the Employment Department to find a good solution to this issue.
Thank you.
Item number three on the list is departmental priority of 14. This is the Trade Act program. Many of you are aware over the years as Trade Act program and the North American Free Trade Act has gone through, it was an attempt by the federal government to ease the impact of foreign competition. This Trade Act program gets into that arena. There are in the last completed fiscal year, 1,257 people that exited the program. These were people that were identified by their employer as being impacted by foreign competition. The steps that we go through on this program is an employer or a business within the state of Oregon makes an application to the federal government to say that we have workers who are going to be negatively impacted by foreign competition. They go through a certification process, and at the end of that process, if that employer is certified, their employees then become eligible for this program. The intent of the program is to provide training to those people so that they can transition to another industry or another job. And so in this, as we talk about the funding for that, there's $18 million that is included in our budget that pays for training for these individuals. They're referred to community colleges and trade schools to receive that training. While they're in training, they are eligible for unemployment insurance benefits so that it helps them make ends meet while they're in training. About $3 million is used for administration of the program, and we have approximately 17 staff that provide that across the state. The next item, which is Department Priority 15, is a claimant reemployment program. This is a smaller grant that the Department of Labor gives to the Employment Department. We use these funds to provide enhanced services to unemployment insurance claimants who may have been identified as having some specific barriers to reemployment. They need some specific job search assistance in looking for a job. This is composed of about 9 FTE that we have in a number of offices across the state. The next one is the Work Opportunity Tax Credit. In this program, we do certifications, about 9,000 certifications a year that provides employers an incentive in the form of tax credits to hire certain target group members. These are federal funds that come in a grant. We have a couple of people that process the certifications and forward them on to the federal government.
I'm going to stop you really quick there. Mm-hmm. Can you give us just a little bit more detail both on the claimant reemployment and the work opportunity tax credit on the type of citizens who are being assisted through these two programs?
Certainly. Let me start with the work opportunity tax credit. And on the work opportunity tax credit, it typically is the targeted groups include temporary assistance for needy family recipients, food stamp recipients between the ages of 18 and 24, qualified ex-felons, high-risk youth between the ages of 18 and 24, vocational rehabilitation referrals, summer youth ages 16 to 17, supplemental security income recipients, and veterans who are also recent food stamp recipients. This would be low-income veterans.
Thank you.
That's for the Work Opportunity Tax Credit.
Thank you.
For the Claimant Reemployment Program, that program is offered in our local offices, and we provide enhanced services to those individuals. And so when a person comes into our office, We have what we call job and career centers that provide vocational guidance. We have computers that people are able to look up jobs. With some people that are coming in, claimants, they have had a job previously that might, for instance, I'll use myself as an example. I might qualify for the claimant reemployment program because I'm very good at counting beans and presenting the flavor of the beans and their texture to you as a legislative body, but I'm not very good at many other things. And so if I were to become unemployed, I might have some barriers to employment because I'm used to having a certain wage and counting beans. And so I go in and I get some special guidance that says bean counters may not in the future be something that a lot of people want. We need to have you look at some of your transferable skills to see what other things you can do. And so I will go in, and many times people can avail themselves of self-service. For me, they would take me back behind the counter, set me at a desk, and go through a number of the opportunities that I've got. They would go through training programs that are available to me, opportunities within community colleges. They would also talk about the reality of the vocation that I have and what kind of things that I could do in the economy within Oregon. Okay. We have 9 staff that do that. This is a federal grant that isn't intended to serve everybody. It is intended to be almost a pilot. What can we do with enhanced services to claimants?
Thank you. Please, Senator Morrison.
Thank you. Do you have available to us the number of recipients of these programs that you, lives you touch and help?
Right, we can certainly get that information to you. In total for the Employment Department, when we look at claimants, we have nearly 300,000 claimants that were available during the past year. Of those 300,000 claimants that we provide services to and registered them, there were about 20,000 that we were directly responsible for hires of getting them back to work. For this program itself, we can certainly, Mr. Chair, Senator Morse, get you some more information on that.
Mr. Chairman, it just would be of interest to look at the dollars and look at the number of people and those that are receiving benefits, just to get some kind of a feel of things working. I assume they are, but we would never know by this data.
Would it be possible to get additional information?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morse, yes, we'll put that together.
Thank you. And one of the things I learned from my good colleague this morning, Senator Johnson, is I would ask any information that is provided to one member that you would run it through and we could provide it to all the members. Thank you for that. Lesson learned.
The very last item on here is called foreign labor certification. On this program, it's funded by the federal government. We have a couple of people in our central office that processes these certifications. During last year, we received about 1,100 requests for certifications. In this one, local employers, Oregon employers, have identified a need within their workforce that current citizens are unable to provide, and so they may hire people from another country. This is a certification process that assures that the federal government believes that those employers truly do need to go outside of the borders of the United States before they can hire someone to provide a very specific service, and that we do about 1,100 certifications on that per year. Okay. Any questions on the business? And the fund sources, just real quickly going over this again, at the top, the $60 million comes from the CDAF, Supplemental Employment Department Administrative Service Fund. The federal funds come from the Wagner-Peiser Act. Many of the funds in column 9 come from the Federal Unemployment Tax Act as its original source. The Department of Labor then further divides it up into these various program areas. The non-limited other funds come from the federal government. Those are classified as other funds, but they go out as payments for training that are available to the Trade Act individuals. Okay. Thank you very much. Yes.
Any questions? Senator Morris.
If I was absent, I apologize. But has C-12 been addressed? Page C-12. There are a number of questions with respect to it appears to be offering services to our most vulnerable job seekers.
Well, I'll tell you what, Senator Morris. We did such a good job yesterday expediting our process that we have time today to ask those questions. So feel free.
Well, I apologize if this is. Has this already been covered?
This is not.
Okay.
No, please.
Well, thank you. Could you explain the contracts and then address the decline in contracts from one biennium to the next, and then why corrections has no service?
Right.
Would, please.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morse, this begins on a previous page on C-11. It is one of our budget packages that we're asking for staff. In this package, what the Employment Department has done over the years is provided placement services to other, primarily to other state agencies. We have come to the legislature during each session and asked for what we felt was an appropriate number of positions to provide those services, and the legislature has always given those to us as limited duration positions so that we could come back the next session, talk to you about the number of contracts that we have and the number of staff that that we would like to have to provide that service. The information that is on these two pages indicates that the department believes that we need 25 positions to provide these services to our partners. Senator Morse, when you ask about why is a reduction in the number of contracts that we have here, it is primarily a result of our partners who are making choices about how they spend their program funds or the availability of those program funds to pay for placement after they have received training or services.
Follow up?
I guess, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The question would be why? Do you understand why?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, why they're not asking for this?
Yes.
These services, they simply don't have the money anymore. Corrections, for example, is not contract. We don't anticipate a contract because of their budget situation. The Department of Human Services has been one of our bigger customers. Their money simply isn't there to contract with us. The Dislocated Worker Program is Workforce Investment Act money. That's being cut back at the federal level. So it's simply a matter of money, we believe.
Thank you. Follow up?
Please.
Statement. It just seems to me that this is a very counterproductive consequence of some of our policy decisions. Our most vulnerable people in need of assistance are not receiving assistance, and it would just compound the issue of getting these people into productive jobs.
Well, I think our good LFO staff is going to help shed some light on this issue.
Mr. Chair and Senator Morris, when the co-chairs reviewed this agency a couple of days ago, that was one of their concerns when they were reviewing this policy package, and so we've asked the agency to go back and review some statistics on the efficiency and effectiveness of this program and to essentially that evaluate as we make budget decisions in some of the other agencies and whether we should be investing more in this area or less. So more information to come, and folks are aware of that.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Good questions. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, our next area is child care. Tom Olson will go through his priorities. They follow page D8.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, my name is Tom Olson, Administrator of the Child Care Division. And if you will turn to the fold-out after D8. We have four priority areas, and we have a total of approximately $21 million invested in, $98 million invested in our priorities for a total budget of $121 million. Number one, first priority I'm on the wrong page. Okay, now I'm on the right page. Our number one priority and the number one priority of the department is child care licensing and regulation, and I spoke a little bit to this yesterday. It is our first priority, and it's the department's first priority because in spite of the importance of the other departmental activities, this actually impacts the health and safety of humans, in this case children, who are, of course, very vulnerable. We have a total of 74 positions in the department, and 70 of those positions are directly dedicated to the job of licensing and regulation. Licensing and regulation encompasses a number of things. Of course, it encompasses on-site health and safety reviews of child care facilities. We license both child care centers, and we license family child care homes. And centers receive more attention. They receive two on-site visits, a minimum of two on-site visits per year. For licensed child care, for licensed family child care facilities, we visit once when on upon renewal of their license or when they're first applying for a license. And then we don't go out on family child care facilities again until we have a complaint. And we do investigate 100% of all serious complaints we receive against child care facilities. And we're frequently asked what constitutes a serious complaint, and frankly, it's just about everything. Sometimes we'll get a complaint that says the child care children are making too much noise next door. Well, we may not go out on that, but just about everything else in the world we will. Our number two priority is the subsidy program, and the subsidy program encompasses two agencies. We work very closely with the Department of Human Services to run a low-income subsidy program for working families. It's called the Employment-Related Daycare, or ERDC, program. And the bulk of our budget, of our federal funds, are directed towards the ERDC program. Approximately $92 million of the $118 million in federal funds that we have go to low-income child care subsidies. Within the employment department, we also manage what we call targeted high-risk population programs, and we dedicate about $6 million to this program. And these two programs are run by two different agencies, but we run them very closely together. We work as closely together between the Department of Human Services, ERDC staff, and my staff as any two divisions within a single agency might. We meet together constantly, we sit together in the same committees, and we plan together to make sure the funds are spent in the appropriate manner. The targeted population program is run from our organization because these are contracts with nonprofit organizations and community-based agencies. The ERDC program works best through the Department of Human Services because they already have a payment system in place for their TANF system. And it's easy to make payments then directly to child care providers because those folks just register with their payment database. In the employment department, we have a very, very efficient contracts unit. We have two folks that manage over 225 contracts. And it's efficient enough that we can turn a contract around in practically no time at all. And that's our strength. And that's why one reason that the targeted population programs work so well within the employment department. Our next priority is resource and referral. Again, I spoke to that a little bit yesterday. There are 17 resource and referral service delivery areas around the state, coordinated at the state level by the Child Care Resource and Referral Network. And these folks are invaluable to the child care system. As I said yesterday, they are the eyes and ears of child care out in the field. It avoids the child care division having probably three times as many staff as we currently have, because we contract with nonprofit organizations to do the work for us. And these folks do everything from maintaining a database of child care supply to providing child care referrals to parents needing child care to making sure the child care providers have access to the training that's available in their community. And our fourth priority is in our quality initiatives. And quality, of course, is very important for child care. It's our fourth priority only because it's not specifically a statutory requirement or a requirement of the federal government for expenditures of the money. And this encompasses everything from professional development of child care providers to expansion of child care supply to grants to counties. We work with the Commission on Children and Families very carefully and very closely to make sure that local child care is addressed at the county level through the county plans. and we provide fundings to the funding to each individual counties to provide discretionary grants to child care providers for things like equipment, things like training, scholarships, you name it. Whatever they feel that they need at the local level is basically what they're allowed to provide. And that is those are the priorities of the division. As you can see, we have a total funds budget of approximately $124 million. Again, by and large, the large amount of that is federal funds. We have a total of about $3.5 million in general funds in the state, and, of course, it's a great source of pride that we are the only general fund division within the Oregon Employment Department.
Well, with that said, though, that also puts the bullseye on you.
Well, yes, it kind of does.
Let me ask a question on that, if I may. Of the 3.4 and the million and the 142,000, are those general fund dollars used for leverage to garner the federal dollars?
Mr. Chair, that's a good question. Yes, they are. And one of the things that always concerns us every legislative session is that in order to draw down the federal funds, we have to maintain a certain amount of what the federal government requires as maintenance of effort, which is spending equal to what we spent the last time that child care was reauthorized. That was back in 1997. And we also have to match a certain percentage of the child care funds at 60%, which is the federal medical assistance program rate. And that means that, of course, we have to come up with, for every $10 we get from the federal government in matching funds, we have to come up with $6 in state funds in order to make sure we draw that down. So any reduction in state funds, any reduction in general fund has a direct effect on maintenance of effort. And we stay in close touch with the governor's budget management office to try to make sure that the entire state spending on child care remains at a level that we can continue to draw down our federal funds. And we're this session, I have to tell you, we're right about on the borderline.
Well, let me throw one more question, and very hypothetical. What if the co-chairs decided that your number one was a high priority for them, and they chose to put additional general fund in there? Would there be an opportunity for the state of Oregon to go after additional federal dollars for this program, or is this the amount that Oregon's going to get?
Mr. Chair, this is the amount that Oregon gets. We currently draw down all of our matching funds, and we're able to do so because we continue to spend on state programs across the state that would count for match. For instance, one of the things that we use is our spending on state pre-K. We're allowed to use the general fund that is in Head Start and pre-K as a portion of our match. So that's always been very important that we maintain that level of spending.
So I'm able to go to sleep tonight knowing that we're not leaving federal money on the table.
I'm sorry, I didn't.
I can go to sleep tonight knowing that we're not leaving federal money on the table.
Unless you reduce our general fund budget further, sir. That's correct.
Thank you. Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Olson, I'm wondering if you have in your performance measures satisfaction of the licensees.
Okay.
How do they feel about the job that you're doing as far as the inspections and the licensing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, we don't have it in our performance measures, but we do it, just as a matter of case. We haven't been able to do it. Let's see, the last time we did a satisfaction survey of our customers was 2.5 years ago. And overall, and we did it because that was the first, it was the end of the first year that we had the authority to inspect family child care facilities, and we wanted to see, you know, what the effect was on the family child care because of having this new program put on them. And our overall rating, we did it on a scale from 1 to 4, with 1 being really dissatisfied and 4 being really satisfied. Our overall rating was 3.6.
Thank you.
And it was an independent survey also. It was not done by our staff. We contracted for it.
To get us back on track, our good LFO staff once again has a thought for us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to clarify some of the comments concerning the maintenance of effort and matching requirements and the direction that the co-chairs have concerning Representative Richardson's Human Services Committee prioritizing this particular division in with the priorities in the Human Services Subcommittee, because so many of the maintenance of effort and matching requirements are integral into many of the agencies that they're going to be discussing. So this, in some cases, is kind of out of touch with many of the subject areas in this committee to prioritize, and it seems to make more sense to put it in with some of those so it's not forgotten. Because, as the agency mentioned, any reductions in general fund or potential reductions, it's not just in this agency, but it's in several others. So it needs to be looked at kind of globally to make sure the entire thing is in balance.
And, Mr. Chair, let me clarify a little bit further, too, that one of the major sources of our matching funds of the, is, in fact, the tax credits that are dedicated to child care. And so that's another thing that we need to watch very carefully, because if the tax credits are removed or reduced, that would dramatically affect what happens with our federal funding.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Our next division is the Office of Administrative Hearings. Tom Ewing. And Tom's priorities follow page E10.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Wessler.
Before Tom begins and we officially leave the child care issues, something you can go to bed worrying about tonight is that the federal government has, through continuing resolution, extended the can of block grants at the current funding level 9 times. And there is a considerable debate as to whether they will be continued again at the current level of funding. So if you want to turn your equation around, maybe you can go to bed tonight worrying, gee, we won't have to spend as much general fund.
Well, you're just full of good news.
I just came back from an NCSL function, and I mean, they were very extremely worried about that.
Thank you. Please.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, hello again. If you would turn to the fold-out document after page E10 is the Office of Administrative Hearings list of priorities. In setting those priorities, I was mindful of the governor's priorities as described by Debbie yesterday afternoon, safety to the public and protection and support of children. So with that in mind, this is where I set my priorities. First priority is implied consent hearings. These are the drunken driving cases. We do about 4,000 a year. If we do not hold these hearings and issue an order within 30 days of the date of arrest, then the driver goes free, if you will. The suspension does not go into effect. So it's very critical, I think, safety to the public, that we do hold these hearings in a timely fashion, and we do. Secondly is the Division of Child Support. These are hearings that will alter or modify existing child support obligations on the part of the obligor to the child. It's generally the father, of course, to the mother, the way that normally it works. So that was our second priority that we set. The third is unemployment insurance hearings. You're very familiar with that. These are hearings for unemployment insurance benefits. The reason that was number three is that if we do not hold these hearings in a timely fashion, then federal funds to the state of Oregon would be jeopardized. That was the reason for number three. And number four is really everything else. It was difficult for me to decide that one group of hearings, one subject matter, was more necessary than other. As we know, I think, under the due process clause, we do have to hold hearings. But if there were a reduction in OAH funds, then what I would do is to delay the holding of those hearings on some kind of basis. So with that, those are our priorities.
Can you share with us the other funds? And
implied consent hearings are paid for. Understand again that we do not receive any funds directly. We bill for services. So it is the agency that dips into its coffers to pay us on an hourly rate. With that said, implied consent hearings are paid for by the highway fund. And I think this comes almost exclusively from gas taxes, maybe from some other sources, but that's the principal source of it. It's the dedicated highway fund.
A quick question on that.
Yes, sir.
Can you share with me, if you know, but if not, I can ask the folks at transportation, the drunk driver who is having a hearing, are they then billed for this service, and the state is then reimbursed, or does the state provide this free of charge?
Mr. Chairman, the state provides this free of charge. There's no billing for any of our hearings to a citizen. This comes out of whatever funds come to that agency.
Again, because I guess time will allow this, I want to ask another question. Is there history behind why the state provides this free of charge to those who are looking to get this service?
I guess that's just the way we've always done business. Okay. That's my best answer for you, Mr. Chairman. I do not know.
Thank you. Thank you.
Division of Child Support. Division of Child Support has its funds both in federal funds and in the general fund. One-third, from what I'm told by DCS, one-third of all of its funds come from the general fund. Another two-thirds come from federal funds. For unemployment insurance hearings, all of those are federal funds. And finally, for all other hearings, it has a mix of sources. A few, very few, I'm thinking of water resources principally, are generally funded. Most of the others are funded by licenses and fees, or fees for licenses and other taxes that are charged by agencies to their licensees and members.
Can you go back to number two, the Division of Child Support, and repeat those one more time? Where the $1.9 million comes
from? It was one-third of DCS funds come from the general fund. Two-thirds of DCS funds come from the federal government.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Senator Berger.
Thank you very much. I guess I'm having trouble understanding why you don't have attorneys as hearings officers, since cases are based on the legal merit. Could you describe for me the typical hearings officer, what their qualifications are? And let me just say before you answer, one of the reasons that I question that is that the cases that come to me as an elected official are very complex. And we see more and more people trying to get custody, whether it's grandparents who want to get custody of a child and are looking for child support, and they're not easy answers, and I'm just concerned as to who are hearing these cases.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Verger, I think that's a profoundly good question. We have did a study this morning. We have currently 65 administrative law judges. 50 of them, that's 77%, have or have held a license as an attorney. That is, they have been licensed by a state, generally Oregon, but by some other state. So 77% are attorneys, or have been. Two are law school graduates, never having been attorneys themselves. 13 have no law school degree. Let me just say that I agree with you. The current minimum qualifications, which I inherited, do not require licensure by the bar or a law degree. It has been my experience that people who have law degrees, and especially people who have practiced, are best positioned to deal with some of the complex procedural and legal issues that come before them. We have far more attorneys today than we did when I took this job 4 years ago, and that is because we have tightened considerably our hiring and screening practices. Many of the administrative law judges, by no means all, but by many, frankly, who were legacy judges, I guess, would not have gotten through in our current system. We really only interview one out of three applicants because only three are able to get through. So I think that given the trend, we will continue to be hiring attorneys as judges. I think that's necessary personally. But it's also a union issue, and Debbie and I have discussed it at length, and it's an important question.
And I want to clarify, I mean this in no criticism of you. I simply don't think life is as simple as it used to be. And I'm just wondering if, because of the complexity, particularly with family situations that you're dealing with, if it doesn't require the assurance to the citizen, that's the person, the people that I represent, that the legal merit that the case is rested on is by people who really know the law. And if they win or lose, it's still, they go away with some assurance that they've been fully heard and that the case is, it's just something that bothers me a little bit.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Verger, again, I agree with you. Let me, I'm a student of history. 100 years ago, our statutes were, what, no more than 3 inches. Today, they run feet upon feet upon feet. And that says nothing about the administrative rules. I will say that when I was first appointed, I read every proposed order we issued, each and every one, for quality control. And there were occasions, more than one, when I was deeply disappointed in what I saw. And for that reason, I did spend the first 2 or so years dealing with quality. It's no good, in my opinion, to have an order that is timely if the order is wrong. We have a duty to get it right. And I'm pleased to say that in 2 years of effort, the quality of our work has improved enormously. I'm very proud of it.
Representative Avakian.
Well, Senator, I really appreciate the faith you have in us lawyers. And although I know that the lawyers don't always even get it right, I wonder if part of this is historical, too, where a lot of the ALJs that you used to have were folks that came up in the ranks, for instance, of the Employment Department, who then had some experience and really some good understanding of the laws, for instance, on unemployment claims, or that had experience in the boards and commissions, where oftentimes you had former board members, for instance, from the medical board or the board of psychologist examiners or something like that, that had a particular expertise in the ethical rules that applied to those professions, that ended up lending some kind of advantage as a hearings officer. I think historically that might have been the case. How much of that is still remaining with the folks that you use?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hawkin, good point. I think that is the reason why agencies preferred to hire their own people to do this. One is that their employees were familiar with their statutes and rules. And I believe, too, and there's no cynicism here, they just felt more comfortable with their own employees doing these hearings. The problem is this. It is not that these employees do not know their statutes and rules, but what they do not know is the whole bundle of administrative law that is absolutely crucial to understand. The principles underlying statutory construction, principles underlying deference to agency interpretation of statute and rule. The list goes on. This is what they couldn't do. This is what I discovered when I took this job on January 1, 2000, that there was competence in applying statute and rule, but little competence or understanding, little skill in knowing all of the other principles of law that oftentimes are dispositive of a case.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What's your billing rate?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Morris, I was afraid you were going to ask that question because the answer is a little bit complicated. We have two billing rates. We have one, an hourly billing rate. We charge $63 an hour for the services of our administrative law judges, cheap at twice the price, I will say. And then we charge $40 an hour for support staff. That's for the what I'll call the boards and commissions, the professional licensing agencies, Department of Agriculture, the smaller agencies for whom we hold hearings. For the few but large volume hearings, we charge on an actual cost basis. And simply explain, and it took me a long time to understand it, it's an hourly billing, but it's based upon what is the actual salary of a judge or of operational staff. It is not sort of a flat fee. I hope that answers your question.
Well, that leads me to a question I would like to ask. Have you folks had any conversations with Boley and those folks and their hearings officers. And I'm curious if there's an opportunity for the two of you to work more closely together.
Let's please.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think so. What I did was I did get in touch with Commissioner Gardner and his deputy, and my feeling was in their response, I was thinking of, and I'm not trying to make the case to you, I offered to explore opportunities to collaborate and perhaps to save monies. I have no doubt that that operation is very efficient, but I think they felt more comfortable in managing their hearings on their own.
One thing I would remind this committee is that we'll be looking at both of these budgets, and that'll be an item that I've got starred that I just want to at least have the discussion to find out if there's an opportunity for a closer working relationship between the two.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, Satish Upadhyay with DAS. Just a slight correction to what Mr. Ewing mentioned about the hourly rates. The hourly rates for 0507 are $9 for ALJ and $48 for support staff. The rates that Tom mentioned was for the current buy-in.
Correct.
A follow-up question, Mr. Chair.
Please, Senator.
Typically, what are the number of billable hours per administrative law judge per year?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Morse, we don't have a standard for billable hours. It's not like the Department of Justice. I can tell you that in this last rolling 12, we billed 263,400 hours, but we do not have a billing rate as such because of our actual cost, because we do this on an actual cost basis. Now, I will tell you that we are looking at a flat fee, and probably if that happens, there will be a some kind of minimum that we would expect of administrative law judges, but that hasn't been necessary yet. There may be implied in your question, okay, Ewing, how do you know that your people are working? It's because we nag them to death sometimes. They're working.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And our last division, Mr. Chairman, is the Workforce and Economic Research Division. Graham Slater, and his priorities follow page F6.
Welcome, Graham.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, Graham Slater, the administrator of the Employment Department's Workforce and Economic Research Division. The approach that we took focuses actually back on the two things I talked to you about yesterday, the quality information, customer service. We talked a lot about that. And really, it's my opinion and that of my management team that if push really comes to shove, if we really have to make the hard choices, the quality information always wins. And the reason for that partly is that if you don't get the quality information right, the customer service is doomed anyway, because you're giving them great, fast service with poor data, which will make poor decisions. So we basically took a stepping stone approach. You can see that there's four, and I'll step through them in a second. But we basically believe that we have to get the basic data correct, first of all. So that's our number one. Then we can kind of move up and look at more of the analysis, more of making it useful and not just statewide but across the state. And that's the number two. And again, I'll go into these a little bit more detail in a second. The third one is where the customer services comes back in, where we actually then start getting it out to customers in our publications and our websites and so on. And then the fourth one is where the best of the customer service comes back, and really the thing that we pride ourselves on and win awards for, which is the customized products, the customized special surveys and reports and service to the private sector businesses and so on. So let me step through those in just a little more detail. The number one for us, which was number five for the department, that would provide what I call the core data, and it's largely statewide. For the rural counties, that would simply give us an unemployment rate once a month. So we no longer have the monthly numbers on tourism or lumber or high-tech for anything except the Portland metro area and a few of the other metro areas. And there's a contract and funding reason why that would be so if we were just to do these number one activities. It doesn't give us much in the way. It gives us no occupational information or career information. We would have basic industry employment information for statewide and metro areas, but pretty much nothing except the unemployment rates for the rural areas and the counties. No projections, no special reports, no one-on-one customer service, and really no publications or website except for a monthly news release, the statewide one, which tells you the unemployment rate and what was going on. As you can see on the chart here, that was about 23 people. And I'm going to mention the funds to you as I go, just because it's an easy flow for me. Pretty much all of the funds here, you can see, are federal funds. And those pretty much all come from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. And they contract with every state in the nation to produce, again, what I would call the basic employment statistics. Now, I serve on some national committees with the BLS, and I can tell you for a fact they really don't care about Baker County or Umatilla County, and it's a joke when I go back there, but they do care about the statewide estimates, and with some reluctance, they care about the metro areas, although Bend and Corvallis, which just became metro areas, that is so far down their priority list, it really doesn't get much attention, but it gets more than Baker County and so on. So that's our number one. It's just do the basics for the statewide and for whatever else the Bureau of Labor Statistics will pay for. Our number two takes those basics and does two things with them. Number one, it starts getting at the issue of there are 36 counties, 15 workforce regions. We need to have some data for all of those, which we've done in Oregon for years and years, and it would be very hard to take it away. It gives us the industry employment at the county level every month, which is what everybody's used to getting, so you know what happened in the lumber industry last month. You don't have to wait 18 months or 12 months to get to those numbers. It gives us the occupational employment estimates, again, at every workforce region, not just for Region 2, because that's where Portland happens to be. Gives us our projections going out 10 years, and those are the things that are the basis for all of the career information that we put out. But that would be in this level two to make those projections. Skills analysis, and then geographic analysis. We're getting a lot more requests these days because of geographic information systems to go below the county level. It used to be that if we went to the county level, customers might grumble, but they knew there was simply no other option. Now we can go down to school boards and urban growth boundaries and city limits, something new in the last few years. This would allow us to still do that for certain customer groups. This would still be no publications and no website. So again, this is all data stuff. It's not really getting it out to the customers stuff. Certainly we would be attempting to serve customers, but that wouldn't be the big focus. About 17 people there. Mostly federal funds on this one, too. Primarily the Wagner-Peiser Act, you've already heard mentioned, which is the big funding entity for our Business and Employment Service. But part of that act also requires employment statistics to be used in our field offices to help the mother who we talked about yesterday to figure out what kinds of careers she might qualify for and which direction to go. So some of that is Wagner-Peiser. Some of it is an Employment and Training Administration. That's a subpart of the U.S. Department of Labor. And we get a grant from them every year specifically for workforce information. That's pretty much what funds our website and our geographic information system. So that's also federal funds. And then a smaller federal funds is called America's Career Resource Network, and that's obviously focused on career information. It's a much smaller grant. So, again, the vast majority of this level two would be federal funds. Level three, the quick summary there is publications and website. That's where I would see us putting in that extra effort. Between those two, we really have about 800,000 of those customer contacts I mentioned yesterday. The careers newspaper alone goes to about 400,000, or I'm sorry, 280,000. Our monthly newsletters, our weekly newsletters, our special publications, I would see all those being here. So we've got all the good numbers done. Now we're getting it out to the mass, the massive audience. Still not very much to the customized customers. The website part of that would be funded by Employment and Training Administration, and on the level two, they would be funding the Geographic Information System. And then this is where we start moving away from the federal funds, which tend to pay for the basic data stuff, and this is where we move more into what Tracy described as CDAF's Supplemental Employment Department Administrative Fund, and that would be the funding source for a lot of the publications. And then finally, level four is what I would call customized service. Ironically, this level...
A second, Mr. Chair.
Representative.
I missed you as you were zipping through the supplemental part of those funds. What's it supplemented by? What's the source? Did I understand you right? You have federal funds on this particular program supplemented by...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Akin, we have a state-controlled fund. It's generated by interest on a set-aside pot of unemployment trust fund benefit money. And that's something that I'd like to go through when we get a chance to talk about how our revenues are and what they look like. But it is interest-based. It was redirected into a special fund in the early 90s by the legislature with the support of business in order to give us more money to serve business and job seekers. And that fund is called the Supplemental Employment Department Administrative Fund, or CDAF.
Okay, and so this...
Follow-up?
Thank you. This form I'm following here, mm-hmm. where it lists these funds as all being federal funds, are these some of the categories that have some of that supplemental money?
No.
Okay, that's all something.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that and Representative Akin, the CDAF money would show up in the other funds column, and we can let you know when those other funds are CDAF money.
Not necessary. Thanks.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Westland.
What's the CDAF fund balance now?
Fund balance?
You have to know that. We tried to debate it four or five times.
Mr. Chair, Senator Westland, you took $15 million last session. Yes, if you'll give me a minute, I'll find it. Maybe once Graham's done, I'll have it by the time we get to that.
Well, we have... Graham, I'm sorry. Please continue.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Oh, this is a bad sign for my number four priority.
No.
Okay. So my number four priority, and just incidentally to reflect on Representative Vakian's comment, you can see in mind that it does make a shift as we go down again from primarily federal to primarily CDAF. And you can see it here moving from the federal funds column more and more to the other funds column, because that's where the CDAF is. So my number four is really for things that we're actually very highly respected for, and some of you were kind enough to say good things yesterday, and that is working one-on-one with particular types of customers, the private sector employers, the education folks, the workforce boards. Ironically, those are also things that are in statute that we really need to be doing. However, if it's a choice of do we serve a few thousand very detailed customized requests, or do we get career information out to 200,000 students across the state and serve, you know, something on the website that all the businesses could potentially look at? The choice to me seems to be let's get it out to everybody and then we'll do the customized stuff.
Graham, let me ask you a question. Yesterday, Senator Johnson raised what I thought was a very valid point, and that is she told us a story about a business looking at either coming to California or Oregon. And the California delegation got in their plane and flew right to the business and said, how can we help you? What do you need? And in Oregon, I'm not sure what occurred using that story. Does the employment department have the ability to immediately respond to a business if they need to know about the numbers in Oregon? And if yes, how do you do that?
Okay, thanks, Mr. Chair. And the simple answer is yes. And I'm glad you asked for more, because I usually give more anyway. So, in fact, in your letter that we brought back to you, Senator Johnson, we did some follow-up this morning to try to get a little more depth than I was able to give you from the top of my head yesterday. Did a very quick survey of our regional economists and workforce analysts, and they're the ones that are all out there, all across the state, Baker City, Coos Bay, all over the place. And what we found was that the vast majority, just to give you some quick answers to your question, the vast majority of the work that we do on those kinds of economic development projects come from contacts from the local economic development officials, whether it's in Eastern Oregon or wherever. Certainly some of them come from the state economic development folks, but the vast majority come from the local folks. All the kinds of information that I mentioned yesterday, will there be an available labor force? How much do we have to pay? What skills do they have? Is this a dying area or a growing area? Those were all among the things that they told me that they regularly have to answer. One of the interesting ones was that they do often present the information simply back to the economic development official that asked for it, and they're not really involved in necessarily the meetings that come after that. However, about half as often as they do that, they are the ones actually making a presentation to a company. You mentioned yesterday, Mr. Chair, about 48-hour turnarounds, and that's why I can go back to your initial question now and say the answer is absolutely yes. We regularly do that, and you probably have some experiences with it too, but we regularly respond to anything economic development related with a kind of drop-everything attitude, sometimes with the people out there in Hood River or Pendleton having assistance from us in the central office, because we've got some resources there, obviously, that one person out in Pendleton doesn't have all to him or herself. Moving on down, I just wanted to also say that we did a special study for Douglas County, just to pick one example, and it's in your packets too, and that was solely at the request of their economic development officials, not because of one particular company, but saying, as we're trying to attract companies, what are the skills that are lacking in our manufacturing sector here in Douglas County? And that little brochure there was a pretty big hit late last year down there. The community college, the workforce folks were all involved to say, okay, now what do we need to do to make sure some of these skill needs are met?
Senator Galante.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm still digesting what you just said, and I want to repeat it back to you to make sure I got it correctly, that in your quick review from yesterday, you ascertained that most of the contacts for business are at the local economic development level. I think you've told us something interesting here. I'm not quite sure what to do with it, but the direction that I'm sort of thinking about is, if the local folks are doing it well, and we have this whole other agency that sits out there, but the contacts are all at the local level, should maybe we turn the model upside down and figure out how to strengthen the local guys, and maybe we don't need a big centralized office if the local guys are the first portal of entry and they have good access to you to get the kind of demographic and economic data that a company would want to make a decision with and about. Maybe we ought to be looking at this differently. And I'm not so much posing a question to you as just musing on what you said.
If you don't mind, Mr. Chair, can I muse for a moment with you?
Please, Representative Malakian.
You're hitting on what you just said better what I tried to get at yesterday when I was asking you about how nimble you were in shifting resources to the local level, because your trends show that there are different trends in different states depending on, you know, on what's happening. And it seems to me that your fastest and best response is at that local office. And what I was getting at yesterday was whether or not there was some method within your statewide office in shifting resources to those areas that need the help the most as economics, you know, situation changes in different parts of the state. Which might be completely alleviated my question if you go with Representative or Senator Johnson in just localizing all your power at that local level.
Senator Johnson.
I think we've been all over the map on trying to do this. There were administrations long ago that had this highly decentralized model, and then we somehow seem to get more centralized. And there are others, including the chair, with much more expertise about how economic development, quote-unquote, is delivered. But it just seems to me that it's something that this session now, as it's starting, ought to be invited to think differently as we get new data to see if there's a smarter, better way to do it.
Senator Berger.
I just would like to make a comment. I think this is the winter of our discontent, because many of us have suffered from the high unemployment figures, and some of us have been doing this kind of discussions and brought to the table since 1980s. And so finally you get so frustrated with the system of how to make it work and what doesn't work. And so it really is beyond anything that you've done. It's a much bigger thing that has grown like Topsy. I want to address something, though, and that's performance measures. And actually, you set your own performance measures. Isn't that true?
Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, we do, but we are required by the federal government to use a number of specific performance measures. So they do give us measures that we need to use, and the ones that we highlight for you, then we have picked and chosen from those federal measures.
Okay. Let's go to customer satisfaction.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that you're required to do? And under that, I see the kind of numbers, 531,409, that have either been in a presentation or received a publication. The mission of your department is to get the worker and the employer together, and they're both happy.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering how customer satisfaction fits into that. A lot of that is making presentations to workforce groups, but not specifically to get the person, the good worker, and the employer together. So I guess I'm asking you to justify that part for me.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, we have customer satisfaction measures for several of our programs. For example, as you talk about getting the job seeker and the business together and making them both happy, that's one customer satisfaction measure. The kinds of things that the publications and the information that's provided is supportive of that, but it's a different operation. It doesn't we don't measure how many we don't judge Graham's group by how many people get hired and how happy they are with the hires. We judge Graham's group by the kinds of responsiveness to information needs that get satisfied and how many folks are get their information needs satisfied. So I'm stumbling a little because I think we're talking about two different things. Our customer satisfaction for businesses and for people who are looking for jobs, we are required to measure by the federal government, and we want to measure anyway, and we do on an ongoing basis, and we can bring you those measures back and give you that kind of idea. But I don't want to confuse the kinds of services that Graham's folks provide, which is really, really a much, much broader, into even a broader range of folks, than the businesses and the job seekers who we bring together through our business employment services group. Does that make sense? I'm sorry.
Very quickly, yes.
Okay. I guess my next question is, are you trying to do too much?
Mr. Chair and Senator Berger, I don't think so. I think as I go around the state talking to business groups and partners and a whole variety of folks, they are very, very pleased with our services, and I think we are doing I don't think we're doing too much.
Colleagues, we're 32 minutes away from the end of our day together, and we still have performance measures, our 10% reduction list, and an overview of revenue. And so what I'm going to ask is, recognizing how much time we have, perhaps you could take 11 minutes on each one of those and help us get through by 3 p.m. Graham, thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, if I can turn to the revenue or the 10% reductions, would that be work for you?
Thank you.
We went through performance measures with each individual division yesterday, and I'd be happy to go over them again if you'd like, or just let me know what more detail you want there. If you'll return to page G18, there's a fold-out page right after that one, and that's our 10% reductions. Also, the tab appendix gives more detail on those reductions, exactly what they are and how they affect, how they would affect our program. So I'm going to start with those and run through some of that detail with you, and just stop me if I get into too much for you.
We have 11 minutes.
Okay. Our first one, and again, as we looked at these, we looked at how else we might be able to do a job, who else does the job, what the relationship is to the governor's priorities, and what the fund sources were as we tried to figure out 10% reductions. Our first one would be to reduce the number of kiosks we have around the state. As you probably know, we've got kiosks which are newly internet-based. They're placed in grocery stores and libraries and prisons and all sorts of places around the state so that people don't need to come into the an office to search for a job. If they don't have internet access, they can do it at a kiosk. Our first reduction would be to reduce the number of kiosks that we have. We would keep them in outlying areas where people don't have as much access to a field office or to a library or to some kind of internet. That would reduce our other funds budget by $324,000. And that money is it's penalty and interest money, which is something that is fungible, to use a professional term. Then we'd take another look at business and employment services and simply stretch out our information technology replacement for another $674,000, again, P&I money. We have, as our third reduction, the child care contribution tax credit. This is a pilot. Tom can give you the details if you want to get into it. It's our third reduction because it's a fairly new program. It's just now being implemented, and it would be an relatively easy program to eliminate in its entirety.
Really quick question on that. Mm-hmm. Has that been promoted to the public yet?
Yes, it has.
Thank you.
Our reductions 4 and 5 are administrative cuts. What we would do is reach into our individual divisions and reduce support for infrastructure kinds of things like personnel and facility management and communications and support services, those kinds of things. We felt very uncomfortable doing only program cuts without talking about the kinds of administrative cuts that would go along with any kind of program cuts. So we set those out particularly. Reducing services and supplies in Workforce and Economic Research Division. This is fairly specific. The Research Division has quite a bit of out-of-state travel because they are funded by the Bureau of Labor Statistics and the Department of Labor, and we are required in many cases to send our folks to places for training because these are very technical jobs. And they need to keep up to speed, and we would that's one of the big things that I think we would take a look at reducing, trying to do that in a different way if we had to reduce our both our other funds and our federal funds in Word. We'd also cut back on things like printing and publication costs, those brochures that Graham has talked about, the kinds of publications that people are very interested in. Our seventh one, we would go into the child care division, cuts our support, the general fund for child care regulation, which we transfer to commissions on children and families. As Tom Olson mentioned, this could be support to services for teen parents, parents in substance abuse, et cetera. As he mentioned, that general fund reduction would have an impact on the federal funds that we receive from the federal government if we were to take that reduction.
Really quick, can you tell why on your overall agency goals it's number one, but in terms of a 10% reduction you would still take $358,000 out of that?
Mr. Chair, it's simply a matter of fund source. We had to find 10% of our general fund to cut.
Thank you.
Number eight, Tom Olson talked about having to take a cut in hearings would come about by reducing the timeliness of hearings, simply stretching out the time frame in which we were able to handle hearings. Delays for citizens who are in hearings. Our ninth one is in the Alien Labor Certification Program. This is the grant that protects jobs and wages of U.S. workers by ensuring that foreign workers are really necessary. We would have to look at alternative service delivery mechanisms with the USDOL if we were to cut into this program. USDOL has picked up some in this program area already, but they have left us with responsibility for quite a bit of it, so we would have to look at that. Again, delaying services to people who need those certifications. Now we're getting down into some of the meatier items in terms of our very basic responsibilities. Number 10 is UI tax collections and 11 UI tax employer audits. Because so much money goes into these responsibilities, we're looking at a fairly hefty chunk of money, $1.4 million and $2.8 million. This is simply undermines our ability to ensure a fair and equal tax system, and stretches out the times that we are able to provide services to Oregonians and employers and ensure those tax accounts are up to speed. In number 12, our focus needs to remain on paying benefits to ensure that the health of communities, to ensure the economic health of communities. If we were to take a cut in integrity programs, we'd have to maintain current service levels in unemployment insurance eligibility determinations and benefit payments at some level, but we would simply begin to undermine those integrity programs. Number 13, workforce analysis and dissemination. We would be in a position of having data but unable to disseminate that to the people who want the data. So we'd be sitting with data on our shelves without as many people available to get that data out to the people who want it. Let's see. Number 14, we're back to the child care division. That is a reduction in teen parent child care support of $71,000. Number 15, claimant reemployment. Again, this is the program where we give specific, more of a case management kind of a support to unemployment insurance claimants to help them get jobs. This would simply reduce our ability to do that and to serve as many claimants in getting back to work quickly. 16, we're back again to child care. We would we pass through money to the county commissions on children and families. We would have to reduce the support for local child care infrastructure. Number 17, we'd have another second step in administrative hearings reductions. Again, it would affect our timeliness standards, and a backlog would begin to develop. Trade Act program, we've got a big reduction of $18 million of non-limited funds. These are the benefits that Trade Act people get for education and training, relocation, and specialized jobs search assistance would be reduced by a pretty significant amount for those people who are affected by international trade. Number 19, we're down to taking money out of unemployment insurance tax employer audits. I guess, again, it would reduce our ability to maintain a fair and equitable tax system. Number 20 is another cut in the UI benefits integrity program. And administrative hearings, what we're beginning to do now is just double up on the kinds of cuts we've taken already. In terms of stretching out our services, our ability to respond to people, and building in delays and backlogs. Number 22, again, workforce special studies and services, we wouldn't be able to provide the kinds of customized services that many of our partners and citizens and policymakers have asked of us. 23, there's a cut to the UI Service Center. We would probably have to look at closing one of the three service centers, the one in Bend, leaving only the two in the Willamette Valley. Number 24, employment-related daycare. This is a cut in the money transferred to the Department of Human Services and reduces the amount of funds available for subsidized child care.
Representative Richardson.
When you talk about closing the bin service center, it's number 23 on the list,
mm-hmm.
and number one was the kiosks, and yesterday I think you talked about the telephone, you know, the shift to mm-hmm. telephone benefits. What is the great benefit in maintaining a service center, I mean, putting it so low on the cut list, if people filing for the benefits can generally get over the telephone anyway?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Richardson, the people in the bin service area are the ones who are answering the telephone. So they're filing over the telephone. The bin service area service center is a call center, and that's where the calls are coming in. We have three centers for redundancy and purposes and for workload purposes, so that once we're all up and running, a call can come into one service center, and if all those phones are busy, it can bounce to one of the others. If the technology in one center goes down, the others are available to pick up that workload. So the reason we have the three call centers is to ensure redundancy as well as to disperse the services to some extent around the state. We've got the Bin Center on here because we could do with two call centers instead of three, but I think the optimal number is three. But again, it's very, very low on our reduction list. We would go a long way before we would shut down the Bin call center.
All right. Just a quick follow-up on that.
Yep.
If you have two service centers, I mean, it doesn't matter. I mean, maybe politically it does and where the jobs are, but as far as the service is concerned, if people are calling in, it doesn't matter a whole lot where the people are answering the telephone to answer their questions. The real question would be how long the wait would be.
Exactly.
Somebody calling in, and have you any information that you could provide on that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Richardson, the Bin Center isn't up yet, so we don't know. We don't yet have the information on the wait times. We balanced very carefully where those centers were, what it would cost for us to move and train people around the state. So if we moved everybody out of Eastern Oregon to Eugene or Portland, the costs, both in training and in moving costs, were fairly substantial. So that's another reason why we left one in Bend.
But you said that it's not even open at this time?
It's not open yet, no. We're phasing it in. We've phased in all three centers so that if we did have problems in implementation, we wouldn't have put all our eggs in one basket.
Okay, just in the final, just because it sounds, I'm getting confused. If it's not in operation, then it would have no negative effect on your current operations, your current ability to provide services, but it might someday, after it is in operation, because then...
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Richardson, no, it's not in operation yet. If we were to not open the Bend call center because we, for some reason, had to take $1.5 million of federal funds out of our budget, what we would have to do is then people are still filing UI in the local field offices in Eastern Oregon in the Bend catchment area. So those folks, the UI staff, would either have to be moved to the valley or that workload moved to the valley and new staff hired if we didn't open the Bend Center.
It's excellent discussion. We're going to
My 11 minutes are up.
You did a very good job. We're now going to move on. Where do you want to go to next? You want to go to the revenue part?
Mr. Chair, the revenue part would be very helpful because it underlies most of the discussion we've been having already. And I will try to do that very quickly. Would you mind? Oh, sorry. What I'd like to do is go through a handout that shows where our revenues come from, how we collect taxes, how the whole unemployment insurance tax system works. And I think I can do this in about 10 minutes. Page 1 of this handout, employers pay two different taxes, unemployment insurance taxes. One is called the federal unemployment tax, which goes to the FUTA account. The other is the state unemployment tax. The first one, the FUTA, is administered, controlled by Congress, by the federal government. The second one, the state unemployment tax account, is administered, controlled, legislated by you. Both taxes go back to the U.S. Treasury. The tax collections go back to the U.S. Treasury and are invested there. The FUTA is in an account, again, that's controlled by by Congress and by federal laws, and it's held there and returned to the states for the administration of unemployment insurance and employment services, including all those smaller programs that we talked about earlier. Wagner-Peiser money is part of the FUTA account. So there are a whole variety of formulas that determine how much each state gets back from that pot of money. Now, an employer looks at the taxes that he or she pays, and we'll see that they pay 0.8% on the first $7,000 of wages for every employee, which is at $56 for every employee. The federal tax is actually 6.2%. There's a huge discount all the way down to 0.8%, or a 5.4% credit, which is the carrot that keeps us in conformity. So if we get out of conformity with federal laws, regulations, or the way they want us to run the programs, then they can turn around and hit our employers with an additional 5.4% in taxes. So that's the carrot and stick that keeps us in conformity with the federal laws and regulations. The state unemployment tax account, also invested in the U.S. Treasury, is controlled by each individual state. In Oregon, again, and we'll talk in a minute about what this looks like, we have a tax rate in the statutes that ranges from 1.5% to 5.4% on the first. This year it's $27,000 of wages for every employee. That $27,000 can change every year, and we'll talk a little bit about how we calculate that annually. That money goes into the state unemployment tax account solely for the purpose of paying UI benefits. It can't be used for anything else, and again, that's a conformity issue. There's nothing else you can use that money for without doing some special changes. But the feds keep a very close eye on how we use that state unemployment tax money. If you'll turn to the next page, I'm going to show you a little bit about how that FUTA, the federal unemployment tax account, the one that Congress controls, is spent. And I'm not going to go through every single line, but there are actually four buckets that the FUTA money, the $56 per employee, goes into. The first bucket is the administration bucket. And again, that's the money that comes back to the states to administer UI and employment services programs on formulas developed by the federal government. Once that bucket is full, then the additional money, whatever additional money comes in, goes into the second bucket, which is labeled extensions here. That money is used when the federal government passes special UI benefit extensions, which they did several times during this recession. So when the federal government decides that people who are unemployed need additional unemployment benefits, that money comes out of that second bucket, extensions. Then when that bucket is full, the money goes into the third bucket, which is the loans bucket. And this is the bucket that states whose unemployment tax funds, tax accounts become insolvent, can borrow from. So in this past recession, a number of states went belly up. Their tax accounts went bankrupt. California, Texas, New York, Illinois, big states became insolvent, and they had to go to the feds and borrow at market rates simply in order to pay their UI benefits. And then they have to pay the federal government back if they do that borrowing. The fourth bucket, then, once those first three buckets are full, goes into what's called the READ Act bucket. This is a bucket that was developed by a fellow named Reed, which is why it's called the Reed Act, about 50 years ago. And the idea was, once you have enough money in all those buckets to provide the to fund what it is those buckets fund, then the rest of it ought to go back to the states. Well, the federal government has only dispersed money out of the Reed Act three or four times in the 50 years that it's been around. We did get a disbursement a couple of years ago. Oregon got $98 million, which has been in our trust fund, but is being used at this moment to as potential backfill for some fund reductions to support some of our services. So that's what the FUTA supports, are those four sources. And again, Congress controls that. We have no control at a state level of that. The next page talks about how Oregon has set up its tax system to support the state unemployment tax account, or the account that funds unemployment insurance benefits. The trust fund is set up to assure sufficient funds to cover future need. As Tom Byerly said earlier, it's a forward funding system to ensure the solvency of the employment trust fund by putting money in when times are good, so that we don't go broke like the other states have done, and don't have to raise taxes when times are bad. We have, again in the statute, a series of eight tax schedules. The average percentage for each schedule is at the top there, so that Schedule 1, the average rate is 1.51%. Schedule 8, the average is 3.10%. Again, the schedules are designed to ensure that sufficient reserves are on hand to cover an 18-month recession at a 7% insured unemployment rate. And we'll take a look at that in a minute. If you'll look at the years, in the bubbles are the years when we were in that tax schedule. Currently, we are in tax schedule 5. You'll see 2005. Last year, we were in tax schedule 6, so we've dropped a tax schedule in this last year, from last year to this year. Schedule 8, we were in Schedule 8, which is the highest tax schedule all through the 80s, and that's because we had to pull out of that recession of the early 80s when we spent down the unemployment trust account and had to fill it back up as the economy got better. You'll notice that in the 90s, we were in Schedule 3 because the economy was so good that we were putting enough money into the trust account that we could be in a lower tax schedule. Equilibrium is Schedule 4. That's basically you putting in what you get out, what you pay out. So that's kind of where we aim for. So those are in the statute. If you look at the next page, then you'll see how that relates to the trust fund itself and how much money is in the fund. Over the years, and this starts in 1980, you'll see that in the 80s, we dipped down. That recession was so bad that we did come very close to insolvency, and we had to borrow to pay unemployment insurance benefits. And through the 90s, again, the good times, we filled back up again and even went higher than we needed. You'll see a dip in this last recession where we dropped down a little bit below the benchmark lines when are expected to pull back up again. The top dotted line is the current benchmark that's in statute. That's the 7% insured unemployment rate for 18 months. We think that that probably is too high, and as you'll see as we go into the future, there's quite a bit of money there. We don't think we need that much money in the fund and are proposing to drop the benchmark down to a 5.6% insured unemployment rate, so that our benchmark in the future would be that lower line.
So let me ask a question on that.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens if we experienced another recession like we did in the early 80s?
All bets would be off then. The current system wouldn't work either.
Well, thank you.
We had our actuaries look at what would have happened this recent recession with all the extensions, and what would have happened in the recession in the early 90s, and we would have been fine with the new proposal. So we think that is fiscally responsible place to be in terms of ensuring that we'll be able to cover our benefits obligations as well as balance the amount of money we're putting in the taxes that we're charging. Yeah, 2 minutes. Every August, we take a look at the amount of money that's in this trust fund, determine how close we are to the benchmark and what kind of taxes we need to charge in order to stay up at the benchmark, and also what the taxable wage base should be. As I mentioned, this year and last year, we charge our taxes based on the first $27,000 of payroll. That can go up or down every year, depending again on how much money we need in the tax account. Both the eight tax schedules, the forward funding, and the adjustable wage base are reasons why we remain solvent and our trust fund is healthy. California, for example, never adjusts its wage base. It charges only on the first $7,000, and it went broke this recession. So that's a big key to our keeping solvent. So every August we figure that out. We send out tax notices in November, and then the tax rate is in place for the following calendar year. So that's adjusted each year. The next two pages are a description of House Bill 2127. Because of the time, I won't go into it. Be glad to do that when we come back again. It has been assigned to House Revenue, and we should be, by the time we get back here, we should be out of House Revenue with it and be able to fill you in on how that looks. But that is the $200 million tax cut that we're proposing by changing that benchmark on the trust fund. That was really quick, Mr. Chair. I'd be very happy to talk to anybody individually about this system. It's fairly complicated, and we're very happy to provide whatever information you'd like to have.
Well, let me on behalf of the committee, applaud you for the work you've done thus far. I think you've set a standard for all the other agencies that will be coming before us. And if any of the other agencies are listening to this, I would encourage them to look at the work you've done, because I think that's the expectation we're going to have for them in terms of providing us with good qualitative information. And so I want to thank you on that.
Thank you.
We do, anyone who would like further information, I'm sure you folks are willing to meet with them one-on-one.
Yes, definitely.
And then also, if you have any questions, particularly as it relates to the benchmarks or the 10% reductions or any other particulars, also please feel free to get a hold of them. So, questions, Senator Morris?
Not a question, Mr. Chairman. Just thank you for your timely response to the questions.
Oh, you're welcome.
Obviously, spent a little evening work getting ready for the hearing today. Thank you very much.
Senator John.
I echo that, but also just by way of a question that may have perplexed some of the rest of the committee. When you talked about the reduction in the kiosks, mm-hmm. how many out of how many would be reduced? And when you said penalties and interest, I'm not sure that many of us, at least I didn't, understood what that meant.
Maybe I can send you a letter on that. I don't know the kiosk response off the top of my head, so we'll get back to with a letter to everybody on that answer.
Thank you.
If that's all right. And explain penalty and interest as well.
Thank you. Thank you. Also, I'd like to say thank you to our fabulous LFO staff who did a very good job getting me updated on these issues and keeping me in line. Thank you. And I guess we will see you in the near future.
Whenever you're ready, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And with that, we will adjourn. On time, Senator Johnson.